From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, Poetics Between Languages, the Turkish-German Experience, with German-Turkish poet Zafer Senecak and translator Elizabeth Olkers-Wright.
When I translate, I like to make a poem that is one that I would like to read in English. I try to pay attention to the music of the poem. I try to pay attention to the way we say things in English, the emphasis we put on lines.
Poetics Between Languages, the Turkish-German Experience, with German-Turkish poet Zafer Senecak and translator Elizabeth Olkers-Wright, tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas. First, this news. Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Steve Brown. Tonight we have a discussion presented by Boston University's Institute for Human Sciences and Center for International Relations in cooperation with the literary journal AGNI. Tonight's discussion is titled Poetics Between Languages, the Turkish-German Experience, and features German-Turkish poet Zafer Senecuk and translator Elizabeth Olkers-Wright. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, AGNI founder Ozgold Melnichuk.
I want to bracket this conversation about translation between two misremembered New Yorker cartoons. The first shows three people, experts in their field, being interviewed by a man who's asked them to identify people who have profoundly influenced them. They're two men and one woman. The woman, a writer, says that her three primary influences were Virginia Woolf, George Eliot, and Anton Chekhov. The second person is a golfer, and he, of course, names Arnold Palmer, Tiger Woods, and Chekhov. Finally, there is a physicist who rattles off his list, and it's, of course, Einstein, Newton, and you guessed it, Chekhov. So the importance of translation, anyone? Juxtapose that against another New Yorker cartoon, which shows two women and a man tied to trees. In front of them stands a formally dressed, kind of primly dressed woman reading from a book, articulating as though she were belting out an aria. And the caption reads, "Americans enjoying literature and translation." That's sort of the kind of cliched notion of the world of American attitudes toward translation, and it was captured in a way by the Swedish academician Horace Engdahl when he complained bitterly about the sort of self-involvement and navel-gazing at popular culture that American literature and letters indulged in. That's certainly not the spirit that animates a place like Boston University. I remember when I taught here many years ago, there was a great translator in residence then, William Arrowsmith. And some of you may know his translations from the Italian or from the Greek. He was the editor of the Oxford series of translations of Greek classics. He once sent some translations of Montale to Agni, and I had sent him back galleys with the translator's name, as is kind of commonplace, at the end of the poems in small type. And he responded by writing back a passionate single-spaced letter in which he condemned this barbaric practice of reducing the translator to a trivial figure, because without a translator, the work would not exist. The translator was rather like the guru in Tibetan Buddhism, who is the equivalent of the Buddha himself, because he brings this work into being. And it's in the spirit of kind of co-authorship in a way that I hope we will conduct our conversation with our two remarkable guests this evening. One of them, the poet, novelist, essayist, Zafer Senecuk, has been called the most important living voice of German multiculturalism. He was born in Ankara in 1961, moved to Munich with his parents in 1970, where he studied political science, philosophy, and literature. He started publishing books of poetry and essays in the 1980s in Munich, winning the Adalbert von Chamisso Award for literary prose given in Germany for foreign writers writing in German. He's also published a substantial body of essays and political and social criticism that's really remarkable, an atlas of a tropical Germany. The essays, while written in the 80s and 90s, feel as fresh as though they were written yesterday, and we hope to we'll get a chance to get an update on some of those ideas there, too. He's also author of a tetralogy of novels, one of which I've had a chance to read, Perilous Kinship, and it's brilliantly funny and wonderfully translated by Tom Cheeseman. I look forward to seeing it on the shelves here before long. And Elizabeth Olkers-Wright, the translator and we won't say co-author, but co-partner in producing and bringing these into being, has published work in many journals. She received a National Endowment for the Arts Award for translating the work of Zafer. She's served as the German language editor for the Grey Wolf New European Poetry Anthology, and along with Franz Wright, she co-translated a book of poems by the Belarusian poet Valzhina Mor. So without further ado, I want to just say one final thing about why I really deeply appreciate literature and translation, because it brings in ways of seeing that the native language simply has not offered us. You know, I'm forever grateful to the Swiss philosopher and poet Hugo Ball for his remarkably lucid definition of two difficult words, culture and intellect. Asked what is culture, Ball replied, interceding for the poorest and most humble among the people, as if from them the noblest beings and the rich plenitude of heaven were to be born. Intellect, meanwhile, he described as nothing other than conscience applied to culture. On a similar plane is an observation such as this: poetry is the view that language has of human beings. And that is Zafer Shenlock's. And I thought that we might begin with Zafer and Elizabeth reading three poems, the first three poems from the book published by Zephyr Press, Door Languages.
Good evening to everyone. Selbstporträt. Mein Lebensspruch ist keinen Spruch mehr wert. Er hält mich nicht auf Beinen. Ich wollte nicht fort. Könnte ich stehen, genügte mir ein Stehplatz. Ich brauche keinen Boden zum Liegen. Zum Schlafen lehne ich mich an einen anderen Menschen. Sollte ich auf keinen treffen, habe ich Platz genug.
Self-portrait. My life's dialect isn't worth talking about. It doesn't get me going anymore. I never did want to go. If I could just stand, standing room would do. I don't need the floor to lay myself down. To sleep, I'll lean on a fellow human. If I don't meet one, I'll have room.
Wetterleuchten. Ich bin am Fenster und sehe, wie die Blätter zurückkommen an den Baum. Treffe Vorbereitungen für meine eigene Rückkehr. Verirre mich im Wald.
Flash. I'm at the window and see how the leaves come back to the trees. Prepare to return myself. Lose my way in the woods.
Rat für die Wildnis. Gehst du zum Wald, vergiss nicht das Märchen. Es wird dich verstecken, wenn du kein Haus mehr findest.
Wilderness tip. If you go to the woods, don't forget the fairy tale. It will hide you when you can't find another house.
Zafer, you've written, for the poem gives no answers. To a certain extent, it is a question, a structure unto itself, woven out of questions that have not been asked. Is there anything more you want to add to that?
Well, when I started to write, poetry was the soil I was going on it. And I was not, for example, absolutely not reflecting about to write a novel or to write a story. I was searching for words somehow. I was collecting words. And this was a work like you do in a dictionary a little bit, but you don't have the dictionary at hand, so you have it in somehow in your mind, and you must see the words in a different way. And this process of looking on words in different ways was the starting point of my writing. And of course, this brings a lot of questions, this type of writing and searching way. And I always had, in the beginning, two languages somehow in my head, because I came as a child to Germany, and my mother tongue was Turkish, of course. At home, I was speaking Turkish with my parents. My mother was teacher, and she was caring very much about it, that I was speaking accurate and good Turkish. And outside, I had absolutely no friends who were Turkish origin. I had only German friends, so I was speaking only German. And I was really in two separated language worlds. And my head mirrored the situation a little bit in the beginning. So I was absolutely also not reflecting in which language I write. I listened to my inner voice, to the voice in the head, and this voice decided the language. And in the beginning, I wrote in both languages, and after 2-3 years, I wrote only in German. And in the last 10 years, I am again writing in both languages. So this is something which is really not managed by myself, by a decision. I'm just following a trace. And poetry was influential for my prose writing. Influential in many ways. One way was I learned to write short. Poetry is to concentrate things. You know, you must concentrate ideas, observations, even a story. And this is one thing. And the other thing was when I started to write essays, it was just going away from Munich to Berlin in the late 80s. I tried to find a language which was not only a philosophical language, abstract, but also somehow like a story language, but an essay form. And for this, also, poetry was very influential for me.
Well, before we get that far in the journey, you have a wonderful sentence in one of your essays where you say that every human being carries a map around inside them, and that is their childhood. And yeah. I wonder if we can go back before that second language entered into the sort of mindstream and hear a little bit about what it was like growing up in Ankara, and then maybe a little bit of what led you to... Well, we'll get to that. Let's start there.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's quite important for my writing. This very early years in Ankara and Istanbul, I came to Istanbul when I was 4, and so I have only very few memories to Ankara, but I had a lot of family members there. I'm coming from a family which is a little bit... a copy of the Turkish basic situation. From the mother's side, it's a very secular, republican, modernist family. My mother, unfortunately, she died a few months ago. She was born 23, the same year when Turkish Republic was founded. And she was one of the first generation teachers, a woman who went out of the home to profession, to outside, active somehow in social issues, interested in many fields. And she was, of course, very interested also in natural sciences, and she was in mathematics, and she was also in linguistics somehow. And my father... was coming from a large family, from a big family from the eastern part of Turkey, very close now to Armenian border, was Soviet Union at this time when he was born, 26, and he transported a more traditional way of thinking to me, based very much in Islamic mysticism. This is a way of tradition which is not so much up to date, unfortunately, because we have this political Islam a lot on the stage, which is in fact not even a political Islam. It's just a broken phase of something which was forgotten somehow, what we have now. And this mystical experience of religion or spiritual, which was very alive in Anatolia, still in the beginning of 20th century, interested me very much, I must say. And so I had two very different types of sources from my childhood. I learned, for example, to read the Arabic script, which is absolutely not the case for my generation. Nobody learns this more. And I learned to read old poets.
This is while you're still in Ankara.
This is childhood. Childhood. Yeah. And I listened to this music, which was connected to this Sufi poets, and which was this was the first impression. You know, you have an impression, and you go to places, and you have some picture in your head. And 30 years later, you visit the same place, and somehow this picture appears again. You know, you have this is a kind of memory which is not abstract in the head, but you have a relation, essential relationship to places. And this is working in my case very much about on this way of putting these things together, music, words, way of, and. This was, of course, always somehow in conflict with the very rationalist part of my family.
Which would be represented by your father?
By my mother.
By your
rationalist.
Mother. Oh, right.
Rationalist. Right, my mother. Bureaucrats and, you know, this type of people who are somehow representing this new Turkey, for example.
Right.
And for them, for example, everything was constructed somehow in a very much Descartesian way, you know. You can explain everything. You can see how it is. You know how it is. And my father had all these questions. He never knew very concrete how it is. He was going around the things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had
And he was a journalist.
He published also a lot of monographies about people who are forgotten from older centuries, poets and
on Turkish history.
Turkish history, and
literature.
And,
yeah.
And he was an expert on this old language, you know, on this Ottoman language and things like that. So I could have it from him somehow. So the funny thing is that in Germany I could so be educated in this traditional things better than I would live maybe in Turkey. There, the Sphinx were oppressed very long time, so it was not fashionable to do this. No, it was forgotten, it was over, and it was garbage somehow for decades.
Well, what was, you know, that's not the usual profile of the Gastarbeiter, you know, family. Mother, school teacher, you know, father, journalist, and a mystic. Also not the sort of usual, I misspoke and thought of your mother as the mystic because that would be the more traditional breakdown here of the feminine and the...
Yeah.
So what was it that led them to leave Istanbul and then go off to Munich? It was in 1970, is that right?
It was, it was just 1970. And I think it was, one side it was adventure. On other side, my father... felt somehow suffocated in this modernist Turkey. This is sounds funny because we think modernity is, you know, liberty and freedom, and you have possibilities. But if it comes to a technique of modernity, it can turn in a very totalitarian way. You know, the technique of modernity. You must really observe how it works. And
you want to say something more about that? That's a nice phrase, the technique of modernity. And of course, I think of the technical side of it, but
no, not that, only. Yeah. It's how you construct it, because you have the idea, and I think that the ideas are very much separated, often separated from how they are constructed afterwards. You know, the ideas of modernity, enlightenment. In the beginning, it's very good. I mean, you have opportunity for people. And somehow equality for people, all good ideas we defend, we stay for the values.
Right.
The values of the West. Yes. I would not even say values of the West. I would say values which were somehow developed through the last centuries to improve lives of people.
Yes.
In fact, everywhere, because you don't have an alternative. If you look, is there a condition better made maybe out of other values? I can see it. So it's for me, it's for everyone. But the question you never stop to ask yourself, how it's really realized? And in Turkey, of course, it was realized in the 2030s, very totalitarian way, you know. I mean, there was a one party, there was a leader, which is still the big figure of the Turks.
Atatürk.
Yeah. And, of course, he had all the great ideas, but how it was excessively put down to the earth was in the a little bit in the spirit of the time, of course. You know, this.
So you're saying that there was a destruction of traditional ways of responding to the natural world and to the...
I would say it differently. I would say there was no possibility more to develop the tradition. If you close the door totally to tradition, you cannot develop it more. So what happened is that tradition closed itself in a small room, and around this you had this new thought, new speech of modernity. But to bring them in conflict, this is not happening now. This is why Turkey is now very interesting. It's this wall between this traditional construction and this modernity. It came down. It's open now, and now there are always conflicts. But I think those are creative conflicts.
Could you give us an example of how that's happening right now?
I can give it example from literature. It happened, for example, in the work of Orhan Pamuk. You know very well.
Sure.
Exactly, this happened in this work. What he did is that he is, of course, based on this soil of modernity. I mean, novel is a form of very expressive form of modern thinking, but he cheered on the wall to this heritage, which is just there. You can close your eyes, but you can open your eyes, and when you see it, and you can smell it, and you can feel it, and he opened it, and then he created suddenly a new world, which is absolutely not a new world, in fact. Everything is in the books. You can find it, but nobody was searching. So this is a very living example how it functions, and you can transport this also in society and in other fields.
So to get back to the transition, that it sounds as though your family went to Germany to seek its past. I mean, is the way you've presented it. And Elizabeth, jump in here anytime and we'll...
Yeah, Germany is not a very special place to seek a past.
Well, you say a number of things about that. You've suggested that those who call themselves rootless have no opportunity then of having a voice inside their new home, but then you also say that how fortunate it is not to have to inherit the particular past that you wind up finding when you go to Germany.
Yeah.
But if you could just... Yeah.
This is a very central question in my work. I mean, first of all, very general question, what happens when you go to another country to settle down?
Yeah.
You have just another past, somehow. And so you share the present, but you don't share the past. It's the majority of people. And so you can't start to question the issue of the past. Because of those, the people there, they also don't share the same past. It's a fiction. I mean, it's a construction, the same past. But somehow, and this construction was, for example, in Turkey, very strong, you know, very much combined to the War of Independence and the creation of the modern Turkey. Very strong positions,
right,
in society and culture. And in Germany, I grew up in a situation where there was absolutely no talk about a strong creation ground. There was a negative talk about how it should not be Third Reich, Hitler, all those things. And now, with the unified Germany, it changed a lot. And this is what I observe a little bit, and I try to write about it and to see it from different perspectives, what it means.
One more question to you that I want to bring Elizabeth into this and talk about translation a bit. But you mentioned that people often ask you about your sort of family history and your personal past, but they don't ask you about the myths
that form your past. And you've you mentioned in one of your essays that you think the sort of myths of Europe are by now depleted, exhausted. They're rote. They're just stories. They don't that don't compel. And you clearly have in the poems, and you've given us a brief glimpse of it by mentioning the sort of Sufi mysticism, but you clearly have a foundation in a personally selected and gathered group of myths and ideas about sort of underlying structures. And I wonder if you could say something about that, the myths that you know, when I was in Istanbul, I remember going to the Topkapi Palace and seeing there in one room where an imam spends 24 hours a day reading from the Quran, because you've got the footprints of Muhammad there and the bones of John the Baptist. In the next room, you've got the fluted ivory rod that Moses used to part the Red Sea. And, you know, I realized again that you've got the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran forming the mythic foundation there. I wonder what other sort of foundation there is, that a mythic foundation that you see there and what you see in Europe.
I see a lot of connections, of course, because I don't have this in my head that there is a border. I don't believe that there is a border of Europe, for example. It's very complicated, because if you make a border for Europe, you have really to draw out the center of the European creation, which starts in Greek, in old antique Greece, and goes to the Middle East. I mean, this is very complicated. The center of Europe is not the center geographically of Europe of today. It's not Switzerland, Austria. It's just on the edge. This is the cultural contradiction of Europe. You know, it's all creation, all the Renaissance. Everything is starting from this border point. So, in this, I see a lot of touching points. But the question of today is how we can reveal or regenerate the touching points, because it became fashionable to have borders again, or clear construction they had what is the border. And I think it comes from a very, very natural human fear that you lose something like your home. People defend their homes. That's all about Europe. They defend their homes, and they don't know how to defend their homes, because this is how we live in the last decades, very fast, changing places, people coming in, you go out, you don't have more the center. And they transform their need for this home need to the idea of Europe. And this is very dangerous, because then you really rewrite the culture history, and you create something which is mythical, but has nothing to do with the mythical background of your own, of your history. And this is, of course, plays a big role in my writing, also out of personal reasons. I mean, if you make this travel from Istanbul to Munich and then to Berlin, you have just this geography in your insight. You have the geography of Balkans in your insight. You have the geography of Eastern Europe inside. You have these touching points, which are also very strong in Germany. You have touching points in Bavaria, for example, towards the south, very strong from Italy, touching points. And this is something which we must really recreate, regenerate, if you want really to come forward with the idea of Europe, I would say.
Great. I want to bring Elizabeth into the conversation, and first, again, also just in the straightforward way of asking how you and Zafer got in touch, how you began to translate him, and something about the circumstances of your working together.
I was on a fellowship year in Berlin in 1994, at the end of 94. And I was going to bookstores, going to readings, basically trying to find something I could connected with. And I found several authors, and one of them was Zafer's work. And I just began translating a lot of his poetry And at a certain point, I worked up the nerve and I wrote him a postcard. That was about. He was nice enough to answer, and we met, and he was surprised to see that I had already translated quite a number of the poems. I don't think he knew where I came from, what I was doing there, but that's how it started. Yeah.
And did you find that was he able to read your translations in English and comment on them, or were you?
The time. His English wasn't advanced uh-huh. enough to read them, I think. Mm-hmm. But he had a translation that someone, another translator had done. And I was able to tell him that mine was superior. So.
A very satisfying moment.
Yeah.
She could tell me everything.
Well, you know, apropos of that, I want to read you a quote from Alistair Reid about translators. He writes that translators require the self-effacing disposition of saints. And since a good translation is one in which a work appears to have been written and conceived in the language into which it is translated, good translators grow used to going unrewarded and unnoticed, except by a sharp-nosed troop of dunnish reviewers. We call them the translation police, who seem to spend their reading lives on the lookout for errors. You know, he then later goes on to talk about that Nabokov says that, you know, a bad novel is simply a blunder, but a bad translation is a crime. And I wonder, first of all, what your own sort of philosophy of translation is, and then what your own experience has been in bringing works out into the world.
Well, Nabokov's translations were a crime.
I agree. I completely agree. He made Pushkin plod.
My theory of translation. I'm someone who likes to read poetry, and I in English, and I like to be moved by poetry. I was excited about poetry and translation when I first really started reading poetry, and I never knew whether that was just because of the English was a little bit different, or I was excited by the different writers from around the world, maybe a little bit of both. So when I translate, I like to make a poem that is one that I would like to read in English. I try to pay attention to the music of the poem. I try to pay attention to the way we say things in English, the emphasis we put on lines, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
For example.
Mm-hmm. And have you been harassed by the translation police in your time, or have you been fairly safe?
There's always somebody. There's always a professor in the audience who will find something to ask you about that you might have mistranslated.
Zafar, I know that you also have translated yourself. In fact, I think you translated a novel by an early Turkish emigre to Germany.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I wonder if you could say something about that and that experience.
I translated this novel for money.
Not love.
It can happen. I mean, you also do something for money for this issue. it's not only artistic issue. But I translated by my heart and by compassion the poems of Yunus Emre, who was a mystical mm-hmm. poet of 13th century. This is, in fact, the only translation I made from Turkish to German. It was in the 80s. And I worked along about this text to find a sound in German for this. It was a challenge. And I think it influenced a lot also my early poetry somehow, this work of translation, mm-hmm. searching for the sound in German. That's all. So I'm not a translator, in fact.
In that one experience, though, were you looking for a natural sounding German, or were you trying to sort of stay true to the original?
This is
You know, this poet was translated several times in the 19th century by Orientalists. Some of them translated them. Also, they translated, for example, Hafez's poems from Persian. And the same thing what happens with Hafez happened also with Yunus Emre. You read these poems, and they are full of pictures, very much repeating themselves. The pictures are repeating themselves. And they are very, we call it blumig in German, flowery. You can smell it. Right. It's flowery. And when you know, you read the original, absolutely not. It's very clear, sometimes very even banal language, you know, very very low level of emotion. And so I was, this was the main point. I was thinking, this is not the thing. I mean, this poet is not speaking in this level of flower language, so I tried to find in German this way of naked, direct language. And then afterwards, a lot of people were surprised because they had a clear picture of how an Oriental poet has to write. They were thinking, is this someone asked, is he from 20th century or from so even the times were confused. Sure. So this was my aim.
So yeah. The similar aesthetic.
Well, I was just thinking with what he was saying. I was trying to present one of the translations that he did of a Yunus Emre poem to a class of Americans. And I wanted to find a translation into English that I could give them some idea of what the poem was like and then what he was doing in the German, since the class didn't know German. And I looked and looked and looked. I couldn't find any translations that not only didn't move me, but it wasn't even close to what I was reading in the German. So I ended up making a trot from the German translation, which felt even, you know, better than, right. You know, even as rough as it was, it right. felt better than some of the English translations. So.
Right. Well, I wonder if we might just for a minute then, since we've gotten into the kind of the nuts and bolts of it, take a look at the one translation that I've handed out of an early poem.
Yeah, this is from this time where I translated these poems, exactly.
Uh-huh, so you can sort of see some of these same questions there. And we have on one side, I thought that we'd begin with, again, the German and then the final version, and then take a look back at some of the earlier versions that Elizabeth worked with in getting to this, because we have just one chance to hear the sound right in a language. And I want to hear about how you get to that final version.
Tierweisung. Folgst du der Spur eines Vogels, so glaube an das, was du willst. Du wirst keinen Widerspruch hören. In der Luft wird nicht sichtbar, jung und alt, heimisch und fremd. So glaube an das, was du willst. Beim Fliegen ist ein Vogel gläubig, doch auf dem Baum zweifelt er. Im Käfig ist er verzweifelt.
Animal Oracle. Follow the trail of a bird. Believe in what you want. You won't hear one argument. In the air, nothing can be seen. Young and old, native and stranger. So believe in what you want. When flying, a bird believes. On the branch, he begins to doubt. In a cage, despair.
There's a wonderful fluency and ease in that final version. And if we flip over the page, you've got several of the earlier drafts mapped out along with notes that you made. And what's really interesting is to see how much of the poem came to you quickly and then the kind of minute changes that you wound up making. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about what you were sort of working toward in the original.
You mean in the first draft?
In the first draft, yeah. And then sort of how you knew that first draft wasn't right and where you would go from there.
The way you just described what what I was doing is actually a good way of describing the way I translate Zafer's poems in general, because they're deceptive. They appear easy to translate in many ways, and you can, you know, write out a first draft that someone else might write out fairly similar draft. Mm-hmm. But then the tricky part is in some of the nuances and the music of the lines, the emphasis. So in this one, I was really just trying to get the words into English, I would say. Mm-hmm.
What were your sort of touchstones in the, what is the prosody of the German?
Well, in this case, I wouldn't say that I really followed the German. I might go about it differently now.
Say, yeah.
Yeah. But at the time, I went more by the way I felt the line, the way I heard the line.
What's the difference between the way you...
I wasn't analyzing the German so much.
Uh-huh.
It was more intuitive, I would mm-hmm. say. Mm-hmm. But I didn't like the third line of the first stanza. It seemed overly prosaic, and it needed to have a punch to me. It needed to... Well, and it also needed to be idiomatic. So that's why I was playing around with different ways of saying that, and it was difficult to make that line fit the rhythm and that I wanted.
So it was a rhythm that you heard for it. It was not as though you were trying to match the original beat for beat.
No.
Right. Uh-huh. Right. And then in the penultimate version, there are small differences, but in that last stanza, if we look at the final version, when flying a bird believes on the branch, he begins to doubt, in the cage despair. And in that penultimate version, you have a bird is a believer when it flies, but on the branch it begins to doubt, in the cage despair. That final one, the final version you came up with is so elegant, so neat, and I wonder again what it was all sort of. What were the decisions you were making?
One of the things that I started to recognize once I got the English down, and I went a little farther away, maybe from the original. When I went back to the original, I noticed, you know, some things that I wasn't going to get, but I did notice that the last words at the end of the last three lines of the poem. Were really important and to the poem, and they were important to me to have them at the end of the line. I'm not. it's not necessarily a practice of mine to reflect the syntax of the original, or to bend the English in that way. But I did feel that this was, especially because it was a short poem. It was very condensed, and it needed to resonate. That was key to the poem. So it was really a matter of going, you know, getting away from a kind of a prosaic approach. Mm-hmm.
And so as you were reading these poems in translations, you were also developing your own sort of your English, which as Paul is now, Elizabeth was suggesting, is something that was a work in progress as these poems were being translated.
Yes, but it was connected more to the visits in the United States in the 90s. Because I write these poems, and as well as translating the poems, and in fact, I don't want to interfere there. Because as someone who also translated, I know that this is also kind of art, in fact. It's not a handcraft, you know, it's not nothing you can somehow teach, really. And you can, of course, speak about it, you can have a theory and things like that. But to hear a sound, to bring it in another language, and I think this between German and English, it's very complicated. It looks in the first moment easier if you do it from Japanese to French or something.
Right.
But I think it's not easier. It's maybe even more complicated because it sounds, it seems to be close. Mm. It's not. It's absolutely not close. And the way to see the language, the perspective on the words, different. Mm. It's very different. And this I understood with a little bit improving my English, which is still not very good, but I could understand that oh, this is not about words. I mean, this is how words are placed on the soil of language. It's very different, and you can brief it in a different way. Right. And so it's, for me, adventurous, interesting to read this text.
Right.
But those are translations. Those are translations of Elizabeth Urquhart's Wright, in my eyes.
Right. So different entities.
Yes.
Big question, just Hans Magnus Enzensberger wrote that the role of literature is to invent and manufacture historically new feelings and perceptions. And of course you know what he means.
Yes, but I will not comment as a writer. This is a comment must come from a reader or from someone, you know.
Well, that may be a nice transition then to a couple more poems. I was wondering if you would read the opening section of Door Languages.
Yeah, sure.
It's the title poem of the book.
Türsprachen. Türen sagen nicht viel, dem, der nichts verrät. Einmal führten die Bewohner einer Stadt, die es nicht mehr gibt, eine Türsprache ein. Geschlossene, offene, angelehnte, mit oder ohne Klinken, beschlüsselt, behakt, in unterschiedlichen Farben. Jede Tür hatte ihre eigene Bedeutung. Vor langer Zeit war das. Heute kommt es nicht so sehr auf die Tür an, sondern auf die Schlüssel, auf den, der die Schlüssel in der Hand hält, auf den Moment der Ankunft. Wer bringt die Geduld auf, eine neue Türsprache zu lernen? Es gibt mehr Sprachen, als es Menschen gibt. Man hat die Schlüssel in der Tasche, den Code im Kopf. Notfalls tritt man die Tür ein.
Door Languages. Doors don't say much to those who disclose nothing. Once the inhabitants of a city that no longer exists introduced a door language. Closed, open, left ajar, with or without latch, locked, picklocked, in different colors. Each door had its own meaning. That was long ago. Today it doesn't rest so much on the door, but on the keys, on the one whose hand holds the keys at the moment of arrival. Who can find the patience to learn a new door language? There are more languages than people. The keys are in the pocket, the code in the mind. If necessary, the door is kicked open.
And I wonder if you could also read the third section there, too.
Third one. Alles ist anders gekommen, als ich dachte. Morgen gehe ich ins Amt, um meinen Leichenschein abzuholen. Ich werde mich von einer Hälfte meines Körpers trennen. Ich werde meine Adresse aufgeben und auf Reisen gehen. Dann repräsentiert mich nur noch mein Kopf. Er allein ist für Vertragsbrüche zuständig. Er bestimmt die Richtung. Man kann es sich niemals ausrechnen, wie es kommt. Es kommt plötzlich wie ein vom Dach stürzender Ziegelstein. Es überkommt einen wie ein grundloses Gefühl. Plötzlich ist man allein mit seinem Foto. Plötzlich wächst einem das Foto über den Kopf. Plötzlich verhängt einem das Foto das Gesicht. Dann auf einmal brennt es. Die Haare brennen, die Wimpern brennen, Tränen löschen das Feuer nur notdürftig. Es bleiben die Augen übrig, sie lächeln ohne Gesicht. Eine unerwartete Person kommt und fordert ihren Teil, und es ist nichts weiter zu haben als ein paar Augen, unter allen Geschäften das Schwierigste, zu verhandeln über die letzten Körperteile, über die abgefallenen Hände, die verstummte Zunge, die versenkten Haare, das verschwundene Glied. Während die Augen sich weiten, größer und größer werden, stellt sich Gewissheit ein, dass der Kopf das Sterben niemals begreifen wird.
Everything has turned out differently than I thought. Tomorrow I go to an office to pick up my corpse certificate. I'm going to separate from half of my body. I'm going to give up my address and go on a trip. Then I'll be represented only by my head. It alone is responsible for breaks in the contract. It determines the direction. You can never tell how it's going to happen. It all happens suddenly. A tile falls from a roof. A feeling strikes from out of nowhere. Suddenly, you're alone with your photo. Suddenly, the photo grows over your head. Suddenly, the photo drapes over your face. Then all at once it burns. Your hair burns, your eyelashes burn, your tears only put out the fire temporarily. Your eyes are left over and smile facelessly. An unexpected person comes and demands their part, and there's nothing left to have but a pair of eyes. Out of all businesses, the most difficult is bargaining over the final body parts, over the dangling hands, the dumb tongue, the singed hair, the vanishing member. While the eyes keep getting bigger and bigger, a conviction comes over you. The head is never going to grasp death.
That looks like an especially challenging poem to translate. You write about it very wonderfully in your introduction, and it made me want to ask how much you and Zafer discuss sort of the meaning of poems as your, in what way you talk about them.
We don't really discuss the meaning of the poems. What we have done, sometimes I'll come up with a list of questions, but they're usually more technical questions or things that I just don't understand. And then sometimes he'll go through the poems just to see if there's something that I've misunderstood. But in terms of, you know, the overall meaning, sometimes for me it's not something I completely understand until years later. So.
Great. Zafer, Elizabeth, thank you very much for a wonderful conversation and reading.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a discussion with German-Turkish poet Zafer Senecak and translator Elizabeth Olkers-Wright, titled Poetics Between Languages, The Turkish-German Experience. Tonight's discussion was presented by Boston University's Institute for Human Sciences and Center for International Relations, in cooperation with the literary journal Agni. Tonight's moderator was Agni founder Ajkol Melnichuk. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jared Mooney and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Steve Brown. Thanks for joining us.